Hello, I'm Chris Robinson, writer and producer of the Forbidden Diary audio drama. I'm here at the MacArthur Memorial Library in Norfolk, Virginia, with Jim Zobel, who is an historian and archivist at MacArthur Memorial. We're going to talk about MacArthur and his first half of 1943. Thanks for joining me, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get started, I want to talk about the POW exhibit at the MacArthur Memorial. It's going on its second year, isn't it?
We opened it last October, so it'll end its first year this coming October, and it'll run through August of 2025.
And you have a new artifact.
Well, we did. We just got a brand new piece from Santo Tomas. It was brought to us out from Oregon. Man drove all the way out here, and he was a relative of the Burmeister family. And actually, it was just a husband and wife that were both in the camp. And when they were liberated, they had a ceramic vase fired up in a kiln at, you know, somewhere near Santo Tomas. Somebody was able to construct this thing, and they etched in it are at least 50 to 75 signatures of people that were at Santo Tomas. It's really a rare piece. You see a lot of the people that had shirts that everybody stitched in their names. We've seen tablecloths that have hundreds and hundreds of names stitched in them. But this was the first time I'd ever seen it on a piece of pottery or anything like that. So it immediately went into the exhibit.
Yes. And that was a big thing back then for people to do signatures. And I wonder why that was.
Yeah, it's very effective. I mean, when you look at them, it is definitely eye-catching.
It's almost like you're putting your print saying, I was here.
Yeah, exactly.
So that is just one more reason to see this fabulous exhibit. For more information, people can go to your website, which is?
www.macarthurmemorial.org.
Great. Okay, well, let's start talking about the first half of 1943. I'm going to follow Natalie's diary. And, you know, to be honest with you, she isn't hearing and writing very much about the outside world. All she writes about is the Roosevelt-Churchill conference in Morocco in January. And then we have to wait until June for her to talk about an American convoy in the Solomons. Does this jive with what's really going on in the outside world?
Well, it's amazing that they heard that. I mean, that's she's talking about that, I think, the Casablanca conference there that they have. And so that's interesting that the word got to her about that. And then, you know, the June coming up through the Solomons of 1943, that's running right on the beginning of the cartwheel operations between Halsey and MacArthur. And yes, they roll right up into Kierawana and Woodlark Islands in June of 1943. So, I mean, she's getting word about something. You know, somebody's got a clear line to things going on.
Let's catch up with MacArthur. Where is he during the first half of 1943? He's settled into Australia. Where is he living in Australia?
Well, the command headquarters is in Brisbane, which is in northern Queensland of Australia. 42 had been the horrible and horrific campaign at Bunagona Sonananda. And this is when the Australians and the Americans had pushed over the Kokoda Mountains, and the Japanese had entrenched themselves on the north coast of Papua New Guinea. They had been pretty much cut off from supply. They would get some in there, but they had built an elaborate network of bunkers holding the jungle, this area around Bunagona Sonananda. And it would take many, many months to remove them, because there's no tanks, no flamethrowers, no heavy artillery at this point. And it's not until they can finally get some Australians up there with some light tanks to go right up on these coconut log bunkers and blast the Japanese out that they're able to take this position.
And when does this happen?
This is going from September of 1942 through January of 1943. So the Japanese had landed on that north coast of Papua New Guinea in July. They'd gone over the Owen Stanleys, because Port Moresby is the main base for the Allies. And that's right on the southern coast of Papua New Guinea. They have 7 airfields there. That's what the Japanese were trying to take when they were moving down so rapidly in the early part of 1942. And they had taken Port Moresby, they would have been able to cut off Australia. You know, and that's the reason why they're trying to get Guadalcanal as well, to cut off Australia from American resources. And so this victory at Papua New Guinea happens almost at the same time as the Guadalcanal victory. So the Americans are on the move. And they had said they were going to have a strategic defensive, but because of those victories at Coral Sea with the big naval battle, Midway with the big naval battle where they sank five Japanese carriers. That made them go on that limited offensive into Guadalcanal and Papua New Guinea. They fought this death struggle with the Japanese, and then the Americans came out on top. And so early 43, MacArthur is basically moving back and forth between his headquarters at Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea and Brisbane, Australia.
And who is his staff? Does he still have the same staff that he brought with him over from Corregidor?
He brought a lot of them over with him. But the thing is now he has a new air commander. That's George Kinney, who is a top-notch air commander. And MacArthur knows he doesn't have to watch him do everything. People always say, what's the Air Corps doing? And MacArthur will be like, go ask George Kinney. He's the one in charge. So he has full confidence in him. And he's also gotten Lieutenant General Robert Eichelberger. He won't get along with him well, but Eichelberger can work it. It's really Walter Kruger, who came in January of 1943, who will be the 6th Army Commander, Alamo Force Commander, under MacArthur. And once he has all these people, he's able to work with them. Those are the military comrades. Everybody else, you know, the Bataan gang, they'll carry out the orders. But those guys are the ones making it.
So he's pretty much set up for the war with his staff.
Yes.
Pretty much. It's pretty quickly when you think about it.
Well, it was really incredible when he got to Australia because there's no Australian troops there. There's no American troops there. They have relatively zero planes. You've got a continent that has no road network. The railroads are different gauges, so it's almost impossible to move things around. You know, and Port Moresby is about 1,800 miles from Brisbane. I mean, you can almost fit the United States in between these places.
Wow.
And so you're talking about these massive distances. And that whole first 5 months of MacArthur being there is just building bases to be able to move everything up to New Guinea. Because everything had been built in the south in Melbourne, so now they have to build all these air bases where they can ferry planes in.
Right.
They have to build troop concentrations because the Australian army is going to come back. So it's a massive, you know, undertaking. And that's what this whole war in MacArthur's theater is going to be, engineers. There's no docks in New Guinea. There's no roads in New Guinea. There's no buildings in New Guinea. They have to go in and basically construct everything. And that's what I meant about taking that Bunagona. You know, mm-hmm. The Navy doesn't want to give MacArthur aircraft carriers. And when Kinney gets up there, our strategy is to advance the bomber line.
Right.
And what you do is you build an air base, you use that to have land-based air cover of a limited amphibious move, and then you'll take another air base. And so they'll move up and up just by that strategy.
Yeah. Before the war started, everyone went over to the North African campaign. Australian troops, they're gone.
Well, they came back, though. And it's mostly Australians that fight that Papua New Guinea battle in the first days. The Australians will take almost twice as many casualties as the Americans. And it's really that 18th Brigade which saves everything because these guys they know their business. I mean, it's all a learning curve for the Americans.
Right.
These are two National Guard divisions, the 32nd and the 41st.
Oh.
They had never encountered anything like the conditions. Half of them are going to fall out because of malaria, you know, dengue fever, typhus, everything else. So you're fighting not only the Japanese, but you're fighting the jungle and everything else. But the Australians are very heavily into it. And they will be a major part of that cartwheel operation in 1943 as well.
So tell me about the cartwheel operation.
Well, this was designed in July of 1942 when they first decide they're going to go into Guadalcanal and Papua. They have a three-task strategy that Admiral Ernest King and General George Marshall have created. And so after that initial phase of Guadalcanal and Papua New Guinea, then they're going to unite Halsey and MacArthur's forces. MacArthur's going to go up the coast of New Guinea while Halsey's forces are going through the Solomon Islands. So all that Bougainville, Choiseul, all these different, you know, islands you've heard about the Solomons, that's all going to be the Navy going up. And MacArthur and the Australians and the Americans will hit like Kariwana, Woodlark, Lae, Salamawa, the Finschhafen Peninsula. And they'll move up towards the Bismarcks, the archipelago, and that's the island of New Britain, which is the Japanese main base, which is Rabaul. Everything is directed at Rabaul in 1943.
So that answers my question about what's his strategy.
Yeah.
So was he relying on any other assets?
No, there's nothing. You've got some Dutch people working there because of the Netherlands East Indies. The French are more with the Navy in New Caledonia, but they're not really fighting or anything like that. You've got the Australians, the New Zealanders that are throwing in some people, and then you've got the Americans.
Native people at all?
That's it. Well, the natives are being subjugated by the Japanese. Now, you will have a great many of them. When you get to Papua New Guinea, all those people that work as carriers, that work as cargadores, those are all natives, and they all volunteer. And there are many people that are so famous that worked in the coast watching operations, and that's, you know, both on the Army and the Navy side. So, yeah, the native people from New Guinea, they immediately see what the Japanese are like. When the Japanese landed at Milne Bay, they encountered about 65 natives. They killed them all, you know, right immediately.
Good God.
You know, and that's just the way it operated.
So that answers that question about any native people that were left, or they were going to side with the Americans and the Allies. So I want to step back for just a little bit and do kind of a sidebar, because I'm wondering, in the second episode, the second Pearl Harbor, I did an epilogue about what happened with Brigadier General Sutherland and Major General Brearden. I'm just curious. They were all tied up with the Clark Field fiasco. It seemed like Sutherland was kind of behaving as a gatekeeper, and Brearden was saying, let's go, let's move. What happened to those guys?
Brearden leaves right at Christmas time. He's taken out. You know, he has no Air Force, and so he basically bails out. So there goes your top air guy.
Where does he bail out to?
He goes down to the Java area, and then he'll go to Europe. He runs Operation Market Garden. He runs the Ploesti, you know, oil raids, you know, two great disasters. So, I mean, he keeps getting kicked upstairs, and, you know, everybody says he's a top guy, but, you know, he has a lot of blunders that goes along with him, like, you know, other people. Sutherland stays MacArthur's chief of staff. He goes to Australia with him. And, you know, he's the taskmaster, the hatchet man. Everybody looks at MacArthur as like, oh, okay, we can get along, but, you know, you better not cross Sutherland. And that's the way it is.
And he stays with him for the war.
They have a big breakup that'll come later, because Sutherland thinks he's in charge and MacArthur, you know, makes it obvious that no, he's not.
In the early part of 1943, what territories does MacArthur have control of?
Well, the Southwest Pacific area covers everything in Australia, all the giant island of New Guinea, the Celebes, into the Dutch East Indies, and the Philippines. I mean, that's his area. Central Pacific is controlled by Admiral Nimitz, which is basically from the Solomon Islands up through Marshalls, then getting into the Marianas and all through the Central Pacific area. And as well, he controls the South Pacific, which was originally under this guy, Robert Gormley, but he failed so much at Guadalcanal, they threw Halsey in there. And so then Halsey is controlling the South Pacific in 1943.
Who throws Halsey in there?
Nimitz does.
Okay.
Nimitz controls the Central Pacific. The Navy and the Army are very divided in the Pacific, and that's because of, you know, everything back home. Ernest King and all the Navy higher-ups, they all are, as Stimson says, very childish in their attitudes towards MacArthur.
That's one of the next questions I want to get to, but I wanted to finish this off. So what are his strengths early 1943? What has he got?
Well, they're on the move now.
Right.
I mean, you know, they've wiped out the Japanese there. They've all of a sudden moved up into the Ramu Valley. They've, you know, they'll do an airdrop in September at Nadsab. And by October of 1943, they'll advance 300 miles up to the Finschhafen Peninsula.
That's
You know, and be right on the verge of taking New Britain at the end of 43. So, I mean, from 43 is really when they really move on. You're going to lose a lot of Japanese air power. You're going to lose a lot of Japanese shipping, because they're throwing it all in there to try and forestall this Pacific drive. And they can't replace it. And, you know, come late 43, you're going to have 18 new Essex-class aircraft carriers online.
Right.
And it's over from then on.
There were three theaters, well, four actually. You had the China, Burma, India, and that was run by Stilwell, the British, and the Chinese. And then the Southwest Pacific, which was MacArthur, and then, so you said the Central Pacific.
Yeah.
Nimitz is running that.
Right.
The Activities and the Aleutians, which are up north, are pretty much over by 1943, weren't they?
Yeah, Attu and Kiska. Yeah. And then that fleet under Kincaid is brought south, and he'll eventually become MacArthur's naval commander.
So MacArthur's leading a army theater, but he needs the Navy. So what is his sphere of command when it comes to interacting between Nimitz?
Well, neither one is in control of the other. That's the thing. They'll always have a divided command in the Pacific, you know, which violates every rule of warfare, basically. And MacArthur will always say that. And so will Nimitz. They both want control of each other. Actually, it's King that wants control. Ernest King is one of the most acerbic people on the planet. Ernest King is the chief of naval operations. And in the beginning of the war, Dwight D. Eisenhower said the best thing that could happen for the Allies is somebody shoot Admiral King, because he is just a mean SOB. The only person he respects and will get along with is George Marshall, who's the chief of the Army, because he knows Marshall is a straight shooter. And these two will be the architects of victory. And they really are. You know, as much as King is a jerk, and as, you know, as much as MacArthur is a jerk, you know, many times, you know, they don't get along. But MacArthur at the end will say it was all because of Admiral King that this thing got pushed through to victory. Because they were thinking the war would go on until 48, 49 in the Pacific. And King got it really going. The thing is when Admiral Hart, who was in the Philippines, left, same time Brereton did, Christmas of 1941, he goes back to the States and he tells all those Navy brass that MacArthur's crazy. I mean, he had been best friends with Douglas MacArthur's brother, Arthur MacArthur, who was about 4 years older. And Hart will look at him as the little brother. Huh. And MacArthur's, I'm much smarter than you are. And so these guys are going to butt heads all there in that period in the Philippines. And when Hart goes home, you know, he'll tell them all these wild stories about, because MacArthur is an eccentric guy.
Yes. Yeah. He's a great man.
Yeah. But he's, you know, he's got some things which strike other people as weird. And so King and all them will just say MacArthur is a nobody, a blunderer, a big mouth, you know, egotistical person. And he might be a lot of those things, but he's also a genius. And so they don't want him to have any kind of role in the Pacific. The Navy has planned this war for forever. This is between the Japanese Navy and the American Navy. And it's funny because I met the chief of staff of the Japanese Navy from a couple of years ago. And he's a big expert on the Japanese Navy in World War II. And he said they could always formulate what they were going to do to counter Nimitz and the Navy because they knew how to do that. But they couldn't figure out how to stop MacArthur because he had no Navy and he kept advancing up the coast of New Guinea using a couple of tugboats. You know, not really, but that's kind of what it was. And so they could never figure out, you know, how to stop him. And that's why that divided command works in the Pacific. Because you've always got Nimitz hitting one spot. The Japanese go to counter that. And then MacArthur hits another spot at New Guinea. And it really played off perfectly.
But didn't MacArthur need the Navy? I mean, they really
were
completely separate?
In the beginning of the war, the Navy has a few assets in Australia. And these are supposed to be, you know, under MacArthur's command. But they're really, you know, they're part of the Navy. So all during the Guadalcanal campaign, they take all those ships.
Yeah.
And MacArthur can't get any supplies up on the coast of Buna or anything like that. There's no charts and the Navy's not going to risk any people in there. Coming into that 1943 period, he'll get this guy named Dan Barbee, who's the amphibious genius of World War II. And the only reason that Admiral Ernest King gives Dan Barbee to MacArthur is because he hates Dan Barbee as much as he hates Douglas MacArthur. Barbee is a genius. He comes out there. He says he doesn't like MacArthur, but he says he's the best boss I ever worked for because MacArthur is... This is your job. You do it. I'm not going to bother you. I don't want you to bother me. If you got any serious problems, then you come to me. And that's the way they like it. They take care of everything. And when Barbee gets there, he has zero amphibious ships. They set up a Higgins plant in Australia, start building all those landing craft like they're doing in New Orleans. He'll get a bunch of these new LCIs, you know, landing craft infantry, landing ship tanks, a few of these things that America's really going to start building up for these amphibious operations. As time goes by, early 44, he'll get a couple of cruisers, and that's what that guy, Admiral Kincaid, will run. He'll run this, what they call the 7th Fleet for MacArthur, but this is really just an adjunct of the Pacific Fleet. And there's like no battleships, no aircraft carriers. It's just destroyers, some cruisers, and mostly amphibious ships. And that's what I mean about the Japanese Navy not knowing how to deal with them, because you'd have a few cruisers and a few destroyers coming in, landing, you know, at these places.
And those were all under MacArthur.
All under MacArthur.
So if you were to do an org chart here.
You have Nimitz under King.
Under King, okay.
And then Halsey's under Nimitz.
Right.
Working with MacArthur in that cartwheel operation.
It's a horizontal.
Yeah, and
lateral.
MacArthur is, you know, under George C. Marshall, and then under him, he'll have these admirals Carpenter and then Kincaid and Leary. And Kincaid will be the last one. And they have this very small force called 7th Fleet, which will be under Southwest Pacific Area. But everything else is under Nimitz. In the Central Pacific, they'll have, you know, dozens and dozens of aircraft carriers, battleships, everything else. But
they're all in their own spheres.
Yes.
That seems, your answer is totally different than what I had expected.
Well,
was there any?
That's why MacArthur thinks it's foolish. You know, why are we dividing all? Why is there not
what
one unified command? But that's what I'm saying. It worked out for the best.
Yeah, because of the
Japanese were always off balance.
Yes,
you know, with these separate moves by these two separate commands, and that's why it's such a big deal when you get to going back to the Philippines, because the Navy wants to go to Formosa, MacArthur and his forces want to go to the Philippines, so they have to decide what they're going to do. You know, in 1944, and that's when they finally unify everything.
Well, we'll talk about that one. Yeah,
when we get to it.
Wow. I just have to reflect on that. That's fascinating. We talked last season about MacArthur being out of sync with Washington's Germany First policy in early 1942. I assume by now he's got the picture.
Oh, no, he'll always be against that, you know, because it's not his theater. There's an FBI guy that comes out there that sees MacArthur, and he sends this report back that MacArthur can't understand why he's not in charge in Europe. He has more experience than anyone in Europe. It's like he's in the Pacific, you know, now he's pissed because he's not out there, you know, controlling Europe.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. He's like, and it's true. He had more experience in Europe than anyone else, you know.
That's true. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, what a guy.
Well, he's, you know, nobody can do a job better than me.
Yeah. So for MacArthur, his goal, one of his big goals, is taking back the Philippines.
That's the only goal.
I wanted to get to that.
That's not even on the strategic, you know, picture, but that's where he's going.
That's his goal. And these people are operating there. They want to go to the Japanese home islands or work their way up to them.
Well, MacArthur thinks that the best way to cut off Japan from its resources in the Dutch East Indies, which is all the oil, is to take the Philippines.
So
and he thinks it's going to be a lot easier to take the Philippines than it is Formosa, you know, especially as things go on and they create this guerrilla movement and all that kind of stuff.
But Nimitz isn't thinking that way.
Well, King doesn't think that
King
way.
King doesn't think that way. In 1943, was MacArthur getting more support from Washington, or was he still a poor relation?
Oh, no, he is. I mean, he's, you know, compared to Europe, no. The thing about, you know, the Southwest Pacific area, in Europe, you know, they said that the volunteer divisions were like the best, the army divisions. Then you have the, you know, the draft divisions, and then you have the National Guard. And they always considered the National Guard like the third tier. And the majority of all the troops that go to the Southwest Pacific area are National Guard troops. And that's why I say that they all came through very spectacularly, because they all suck it up and they all become very good divisions. You know, by the time they get to the Philippines, these guys are on fire. I mean, and you'll get some regular army divisions like the 1st Cavalry, and you'll get the, you know, the 11th Airborne Division, which are all top-notch divisions. But it's kind of that way all the way through. Now, the Nazi machine, of course, is huge, and they need all that, you know, out there. But MacArthur will always look at it that way, as I'm being short-shrifted as far as everything else.
So he cobbled out.
I mean, you know, when he first gets to Australia, you know, they'll start sending a lot of stuff there, and he'll have the biggest preponderance of planes anywhere for that a little while, because they have to have it to be able to hold off those Japanese. You know, eventually Europe becomes the, you know, the big deal. But they do support him. I don't think MacArthur ever realized that George C. Marshall really was the best friend that he had, because Marshall fights for him all the time, you know, to get him more supplies, to get him more men. You know, the Navy and King are always trying to strangle MacArthur out because they believe in the Central Pacific drive. And but MacArthur, Marshall takes care of him.
He has a history. Marshall has a history with the Philippines, doesn't he? Was he
stationed? He had been there. Yeah, he had served there after the turn of the century. But most every army person pre-war had served in the Philippines.
Yeah. In 1943, Natalie's writing more and more about food shortages.
Mm-hmm. The crop had gone to waste, you know, during the Bataan-Corregidor campaign.
Right.
You know, nobody had been harvesting anything. And so that whole crop was lost. And then the other thing is that, you know, the Philippines get most of their rice from Thailand. They don't get it from home. And so when the war starts, a lot of that gets cut off.
Right.
And it's not coming in there. As well, you've got the Japanese taking a great deal of everything to feed themselves in the Philippines.
But is the U.S. cutting them off?
The U.S. has no way to get there at all. You haven't got a big submarine fleet out there destroying everything, which they will eventually.
Right, but not in 43.
Not in that point.
Didn't they have problems with the torpedoes?
Those Mark IV torpedoes that... When the Japanese landed at Lingayen Gulf, they had all of hard submarines up there, and not a one of them scored anything.
Was it a problem with the torpedoes or something?
Yeah, the detonator. And you know who was in charge of that detonator program? Admiral Tommy Hart, who was out there in the Philippines.
So who is in charge of the submarine warfare?
You've got this guy Fife, who's down there in Australia. You'll have a bunch of other people as well.
And who are they working for?
But that's Nimitz's guys. You know,
most
of those guys are coming out of Pearl. You know, you've got a few submarines, and they'll add more to them in the Southwest Pacific area around Perth. You know, down on the Southwest coast, as well as at Brisbane, you've got them a lot. But you're going to use a lot of submarines for guerrilla operations as well. But the main sub fleet is coming out of Pearl.
Early part, again, of 43, Natalie wrote stories about captured American civilians. They hid in the mountains. And the Japanese had a big campaign to bring them, to capture them and bring them in. And one guy, Bill Moole, I don't know if you're familiar with him. So he was hiding out in the village, villages, mm-hmm. going from one place to the other. And he told this story about they came upon a village while they were trying to escape the Japanese, and they asked for help. And rather than get into trouble with the Japanese, the whole village said, sure, come on in, you can have the village. And they woke up the next morning and the whole village had gone.
Yeah, evacuated.
They evacuated. Yeah. So they didn't want to turn them down, but they didn't want to get killed either. How common were these? You know, I mean, there's another one, a guy named Foster tells, Natalie writes about, that a whole village was killed because they helped him out.
Sure.
So these are not uncommon. These are true tales.
They happen all over the islands. They call it buckwheat.
Could you pronounce that again?
Buckwheat.
Buckwheat.
That was evacuate. You know?
Yeah.
You know, and everybody goes to the hills, and they go up there and they can build all the, you know, palm frond huts.
Yeah.
And that's where they'll stay. It happens on Mindanao quite a bit. But yeah, they do. They wipe out whole villages. But it all depends on who you're dealing with. I've met so many Filipinos that said, our village was under this guy the whole time, and he was great. You know, he helped everyone. Because he was a good guy.
Yeah.
But you have some psycho, you know, that runs another place, and a great many more were psychos than were
good guys. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so you'll find that in a lot of different places.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these guys are humanitarians, but the majority are not.
Right.
You know, or, you know, maybe they are, but they're being forced to do it by the Japanese military system, which most of them are.
Yeah.
You know, right. Which is a very brutal system.
So in Bill Moole's memoir, he talks about the first days of the war. Now, Bill, he was a miner. And so when the Japanese first invaded, some soldiers from Camp Hay evacuated, some Filipino soldiers evacuated them, some hid in the mountains up in a Togon mine because they could get food there. And then it became obvious that the Japanese were going to find them. So some of the Filipino soldiers just went home. Some of the American soldiers went to Bataan, and some officers stayed behind, and they went up in the mountains. Captain Calvert, Lieutenant Murphy, Sergeant Spencer, Major Warner, Colonel Moses. Did these officers go AWOL, or was there a plan that some of the troops would hide out and start resistance?
No, they got cut off. The thing is, you know, they were up there at Baguio area. I think you had some 26 cavalry scouts. You had Horan, who I think has the Baguio Camp John Hay area. And the Japanese, when they land at Lingayen, they immediately go up that, was it Rosario Road, you know, that goes up to Baguio, and they're cut off. Now, Moses will get back to Bataan, and he'll fight with the 11th Division. But when surrender comes there, he then goes out again and goes up to seek those people in the northern areas. You know, he goes with this guy, Noble. And so a lot of those guys do, you know, like there was Claude Thorpe. He was sent out by MacArthur and the units in February of 42. And they went and set up on Mount Arayat, which overlooked Clark Field. And they were going to be like an intelligence group. Well, when the surrender come, Thorpe breaks them all up. But then he creates his own guerrilla there. He'll eventually, see, November 43, all these guys are going to get captured. The thing is Guillermo Nacar, who was up there around Baguio, he was a Philippine army guy. He makes contact with MacArthur headquarters. And so they know that this movement is going. And then when Nacar gets killed, Ralph Prager is another one of these people that was, you know, cut off up there in Baguio. He has a radio. He makes contact. But then they all get captured. You know, Moses, Noble, Prager, Thorpe, Hugh Strawn, the Japanese get them all up on Luzon in 1943. And that's why, you know, Luzon will really become a place where guerrillas can't operate. Volkmann will go up into the mountains, but he'll stay in the mountains. The only person that's down on the lowlands is Robert Lapham and Ray Hunt, these guys who are part of the Tarlac group, because they know that's where the Japanese are. And they're like Arafat. They don't sleep in the same place every night. You know, they change where they sleep every day. And so you're going to have this guerrilla movement that tries to become on Luzon like all the other guerrilla movements on the other islands, which they basically control a major part of the islands. But that's not going to happen on Luzon because there's too many Japanese troops.
So he's concentrating on the southern, just like he's moving up north, you know.
Yeah, like Papua when those guys leave Bataan and escape Bataan, there was a place called Fasith Camp, which was right north of those mountains, Sierra Madres. And all these, about 300, you know, that I've heard were at this camp that had escaped Bataan. And they'll all either surrender later or they'll move out into these other areas.
What is MacArthur's strategy for using these assets?
Well, he doesn't even know about them until, like I said, until about September of 1942. And then he knows something's going on. And 2 months later, that's when he sends in the first insert. And that's Jesus Villamor, who was the great Filipino pilot.
But everybody knows him, right?
Yes. He'll go into Negros Island in November of 1942. That's when the ship leaves Brisbane. They'll drop off in December. But yes, he's so famous, he can't really move around. But MacArthur is using these people to try to figure out just what's going on.
So in 43, he's just gathering intelligence, right?
Yeah, and that's what he wants him to do, because he'll send in, after that, he'll send in Chick Parsons, who's very famous in the Philippines because he ran Luzon stevedoring. Mm-hmm. And then he got out of the Philippines by saying he was a Panamanian consul. As soon as he got to Washington, MacArthur was like, send him out here. As soon as he arrived in Australia, MacArthur put him on a submarine to go into the Philippines. And Parson goes in there, figures out what's going on, organizes coast watchers, all these things.
When is this happening?
This is happening March of 43. Yeah, March, April of 1943, they go in.
So he does have submarines. MacArthur is using submarines.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I said. When they have them at Fremantle, they have, you know, submarines, but they'll be using a lot of them for these guerrilla ops.
Right.
The Navy doesn't want to do that. Well, the thing is when Parsons goes in and they set up all these coast watching stations at Davao, right at the Surigao Straits there, that's giving the Navy all these targets to sink with submarines. So they like this. And so they're like, okay, we're going to give you some more submarines to start bringing in supplies, all stuff, as long as you're feeding us information.
But it's not this kumbaya thing, everybody working together. It's just because it works to the Navy's advantage.
Well, you know, even on these ships, like the Navy gives MacArthur the two biggest submarines they have, which is the Narwhal and the Nautilus. And these guys are ferrying supplies, ferrying agents in, they're removing civilians from the Philippines. But the thing is their main thing is to still sink Japanese ships. And there's one point in November of 43 when all these civilians get on the Narwhal, and this guy's going on a hunt, you know, and because that's their job.
Wow. So MacArthur's supporting them by, is he supporting the guerrillas in any other way? Is he giving them supplies?
Yeah.
He's giving them people, but.
After you sent in Villamor, there was Marcario Peralta, and he was a former 61st Division officer. And he takes over as the guerrilla leader on Panay. And he gets contact with this station KFS in San Francisco, who then relays it to, you know, War Department, hey, we're getting these signals from this guy that's left behind in the Philippines. At the same time that Peralta gains contact with MacArthur's headquarters, this guy Charlie Smith takes a sailboat from Mindanao and sails to Australia. And he was best friends with this guy, Wendell Fertig, who sets up the guerrilla command on Mindanao. Now, Fertig thought, I've been chosen by God to lead the Filipinos. And Smith was like, well, you have fun with that. I'm getting out of here. And, you know, never been in a sailboat before. Sails it like 2,000 miles to Australia. And as soon as he gets there, he's able to give them the coordinates to then set up radio contact with Fertig's group. Right. Because they've been working on getting all these radios going. And they had to get the crystals all set just right, to be able to do that. And so now you've got contact with Panay, Negros, and Mindanao. And so that's when they have that contact with Fertig. That's when they send in that Smith guy who sailed
the sailboat.
It was like, you know, when Smith gets to Australia, MacArthur's like, wow, you sailed a sailboat the whole way here. Guess what? You're going back. And he puts him on that submarine with Parsons. And Smith is the guy who organizes all those coast watchers at Davao. And Parsons does them up on Leyte. They get a look at everything going on in Fertig. And they start bringing in, you know, weapons, everything. And the thing is like on Mindanao,
Are they bringing in weapons in early of 43?
Oh yeah, yeah, wow. Yeah. They're not a lot. There'll be a lot more later, but they want to show the guerrillas that hey, you know,
we support you.
Because see, Fertig is trying to get all the Muslims to join him, and Mindanao has always been the worst Christian Muslim fighting since time immemorial.
Right.
As soon as the Muslims see all that stuff coming in, you know, BARs, machine guns, everything, we want to join you too. And it's the first time that Muslims and Christians have ever worked together against the Japanese.
Wow. I want to get into that a little bit more in our next session. But
sure.
So in June of 43, we'll end this with Natalie gets the second big bit of news other than the Moroccan conference, and that's about they hear word about a convoy in the Solomons near Guadalcanal.
Yeah.
So what we've already spoken about this. Yeah. That's old news.
Yeah, but it's finally gotten through to them. Yeah.
Right, and we all
because
know
because by June of 43, you know, Guadalcanal's already fallen. You know, months later.
So that's about all the exciting news Natalie heard during the first part of 43. But things started, as we've touched upon, things started to pick up on the second half of the year.
Oh, yeah.
And Jim and I will talk more about that in our next conversation, which you can hear after episode 20, which is the season 3 finale. In the meantime, if you're ever in Norfolk, Virginia, be sure to visit the MacArthur Memorial Museum or listen to the Memorial's podcasts about MacArthur and his life and times. If you like our conversations, you're going to love these podcasts. And again, where can listeners find those podcasts, Jim?
Well, they can get those on iTunes. But if you go to YouTube on our MacArthur Memorial channel, you'll see our educator has gotten, during the camps, they had the recipe craze.
Yeah.
Because nobody had any food.
Yeah.
So they all just wrote all their recipes and traded them with everyone, and everybody collected thousands of recipes. Well, our educator makes all that food. She uses those recipes to make everything. And she has videos of making all these Santo Tomas Bilibid prison camp recipes.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
You can see that on YouTube as well. All the stories about the guerrillas, all the stories about, you know, all these campaigns and everything.
And there's a visual to it too.
Yeah.
Which is, which
is, we've made a lot of movies. We've laid, you know, done a lot of, you know, various things.
Great. So just do a search on MacArthur Memorial on YouTube, right?
Yeah. And MacArthur Memorial and all our things will come right up.
Okay. Well, thank you for talking with me, Jim. And we'll talk to you next time around.
Sounds good.
Thanks.
Bye.
Be sure to tune in for the next episode of Forbidden Diary.